Arizona made national headlines again in 2014 for the controversy surrounding SB 1062 and for being the place where the VA healthcare scandal was first made public. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, I'll talk with commentators Chip Scutari and Karina Bland about what they'll remember most about 2014. We'll discuss election results and which officials they'll be watching closely in 2015. Also, what'll be the issues surrounding K-12 education in Arizona? Will districts get enough funding? What about Common Core? Plus, some major reforms of child protective services were implemented. Will they be enough, or will the decades-long troubles and complications continue? Also, we'll revisit some favorite interviews of 2014, including a conversation about arguably Arizona's most well-known artist, Ted DeGrazia. And we'll close the year with some laughs with comedian Chelsea Peretti and actress and writer Jenny Mola. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. The U.S. has released five men who were held at the military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, without charge for more than a decade. As NPR's Jackie Northam reports, the men were flown to Kazakhstan.
This latest prisoner release from Guantanamo includes two men from Tunisia and three Yemenis. All were rounded up in Pakistan nearly 12 years ago. They're all considered low risk and were cleared for transfer from the military prison camp years ago. But they could not be sent back to their home countries, in part out of fear of persecution. This is the first time the Central Asian nation of Kazakhstan has accepted a Guantanamo inmate. 28 prisoners have been released from Guantanamo this year, the most in any one year since the camp started housing terror suspects in early 2002. At least 120 men suspected of terrorism remain at the military prison. President Obama recently said he wanted to accelerate the rate of releases. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Washington.
High seas and strong winds are hampering efforts to recover AirAsia's Flight 8501. Debris has been found in shallow waters of the Java Sea off of Borneo, and solar pings indicate a large mass nearby may be part of the missing aircraft. Tony Fernandez, AirAsia's chief executive, told the BBC he welcomes word that recovery efforts are ongoing.
The weather, unfortunately, is not looking good for the next two or three days. And that is slowing us down. But they did inform me that the ships are looking to operate 24 hours, which is very encouraging. And they're moving all the assets to the two spots which they think the aircraft could be, where the aircraft could be.
Search and rescue coordinators say that debris and bodies are drifting in the heavy weather. The new year approaches, and with it, optimism about the U.S. economy. As NPR's Chris Arnold tells us, one piece of the economy, housing, has yet to recover its pre-recession strength.
The U.S. economy has a lot going for it right now. We're on track this year to see the most job gains since 1999. Cheaper gas is putting more money into people's pockets, but housing still hasn't recovered. New home construction remains near an all-time low, going back as far as we have records for. All this is puzzling to some economists who think that housing should be recovering a little better than it is, especially given what's happening in the jobs market. One likely culprit, though, you still need a much higher credit score than you traditionally did to get a home loan. So one thing to look for in 2015 is whether that changes. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
The National Association of Realtors says there was an uptick in new home contracts in November, up about 4%. On Wall Street, the Dow down 30, NASDAQ down 49. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Good morning from KJZZ News in Phoenix. I'm Bruce Drummond. The Arizona Supreme Court this morning ruled that a minority of lawmakers have the right to challenge Governor Jan Brewer's expansion of the state's Medicaid program. The court's ruling does not settle the matter, but gives the minority of lawmakers who opposed the expansion the legal standing to go to court. KJZZ's Al Macias has more.
The lawmakers who lost the vote in 2013 have argued that the legislation that allowed Medicaid expansion was actually a tax. In Wednesday's ruling, the state's high court said if the assessment on hospitals which funded the expansion is a tax, then it needed a two-thirds approval from the legislature. It passed by a simple majority. Today's ruling does not end the legal fight. Instead, it simply gives the dissident lawmakers the go-ahead to now try to prove that the levy is a tax and get a court ruling that it was illegally enacted. The expansion added about 300,000 people to the state's health care rolls. If the lawmakers win their challenge, the $256 million from hospitals being used to fund Medicaid expansion dries up. That would leave Governor-elect Doug Ducey and the new legislature having to find another source of cash or removing hundreds of thousands from the program. Al Macias, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Snow and ice on roadways is keeping the Arizona Department of Transportation busy today. The agency says it has more than 200 plows clearing the roads. ADOT's Tom Herman says there isn't any place across the state that hasn't been affected by this latest winter storm.
We're seeing more snow on the area just south of Flagstaff, also in the Camp Verde area, not just on I-17, but on State Route 260 going east from Camp Verde and on State Route 87 in that area north of Strawberry. Those areas have been reporting very heavy snow, but pretty much every place at a higher elevation, there's certainly a hazard of snow. There's certainly something to keep an eye on for drivers.
Two earlier crashes on I-40 have led to closures on the eastbound lanes at mile 48 west of Kingman and mile 74 east of U.S. 93. Ice contributed to the crash at mile 48. There's another road closure on State Route 68 just west of Laughlin. This is KJZZ News.
KJZZ is supported by the Herd Museum, hosting Holidays at the Herd, a Southwestern tradition, where you can enjoy fry bread, native music and cultural performances, and more. December 26th through December 31st. Herd.org.
Light rain and 44 degrees in Phoenix. It's 11:06.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning and Happy New Year. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, we'll look back at Arizona in 2014, including the controversies surrounding SB 1062 and VA health care. Election results were important. Who will have the biggest impact in 2015? And how will the approval of same-sex marriage affect Arizona? Plus, an encore interview about the man who is arguably the most well-known artist in Arizona history, Ted DeGrazia. How did he become so famous, and how did his art reflect his Arizona experiences? And as you get ready to celebrate the new year, we'll take you back to conversations we had with two very funny people, comedian and actress Chelsea Peretti, and humorist and actress Jenny Molin. We start today's program with Chip Scutari of the firm Scutari & Sizlak, and Karina Bland, Arizona Republic columnist, as we review 2014 in Arizona and look ahead to 2015. Chip and Karina, welcome. 2014 was an election year, so what themes do you take from it? What were pleasant, maybe unpleasant surprises?
I think the whole election of 2014, I'm stealing someone's line, which I'm good at. Someone called it the Jerry Seinfeld election, based on the TV show, because it really was about nothing and everything at the same time. There was no one defining issue. It was pretty much the Republican playbook was, let's bash President Obama as much as we can and see how far we can go with it. And then we'll be fueled by a lot of outside money, which is now called dark money. And it seemed to work quite well. They won all statewide offices. They picked up a congressional seat in Tucson with Martha McSally, former fighter pilot who's now going to be in Congress. And the Democrats, and I have a lot of Democrat friends, maybe our co-host and studio, Karina Bland's a Democrat, they really need to find a pulse because their infrastructure, their party message, something's sorely missing. The one who's the most intriguing going forward to me, I think two. One is the previously mentioned Martha McSally, who defeated Ron Barber down in Pima County in Tucson, former fighter pilot. She's in a unique position because she's in an ultimate swing district, which can go either to Democrat or Republican. And I think the Republican leadership in Washington, D.C., especially guys like House Speaker John Boehner, will make sure they want her around for a long time. So look for her, whatever she wants on in appropriations, in armed services. She's going to be on the Armed Services Committee. She should get a lot of what she wants because she's in that important seat. The other person that's going to be fascinating to watch moving forward is the new governor, Doug Ducey, because he's going to bring in a lot of new blood, new talent, and it's a whole new world. I mean, when you think of 2010 when Governor Brewer was reelected compared to now, I mean, just think about this on the drive over here. We have gay marriage has been legalized, dreamers can drive. Marijuana, there'll probably be something on the 2016 ballot to legalize marijuana. Those are big changes. So he's operating in a different world than Jan Brewer. Mm-hmm. He's a lot younger. He's from the Midwest. He comes from the private sector. So his leadership style will be different. It'll be fascinating to watch moving forward.
Yeah, Karina, let's get started with your thoughts about the election results and who's standing out to you as far as looking ahead.
Well, I do think that Governor Ducey will be interesting to watch because he does come in at a time where, much like when Governor Brewer came in, that he's facing some tough financial decisions. And so, you know, you want to be able to start a term with some positive movement, and I don't know if he's going to be able to do that right off the bat. The other person I was really fascinated with is Diane Douglas, the new superintendent of public instruction, because I'm not sure what happened, but no one really seemed to be paying too much attention to her. That I don't think anyone really thought she was going to be elected. And then when she did, there was sort of this panic on, you know, what will she do in terms of her views on Common Core, and what does that mean for Arizona in education? You know, she seems to kind of be a mystery. I mean, there are people who love her, people who hate her, but really, there's no track record to follow closely to kind of even predict what she might do. So I think that will be interesting.
Just to piggyback on what Karina just said about Diane Douglas, the thing that was very depressing to me as a political junkie and father of three was the low turnout. It was pathetic. So we have all these smartphones. We have Twitter. We have Facebook. We have Instagram. And no one's voting. I mean, it's pretty bad. And hopefully the trend will, you know, change in 2016 with the presidential race. But we have all this information at our fingertips. And I don't know if it was the influence of dark money, the high sense of negativity, people just tuning out. Is it, you know, people, you know, the economy still unsettled, so people are just angry at the world. But that was pretty unsettling to me. And I think, you know, that has to change moving forward, and there's no, you know, silver bullet to fix that. The other thing about Diane Douglas and this whole Common Core debate, which just makes me irritated because, you know, two of my three children go to Scottsdale Public Schools. They have instituted higher, more rigorous academic standard 2 or 3 years ago. So this is clearly it's blatant political argument. You know, I don't think Washington, D.C. is dictating what my son's math test will be like. So hopefully calmer heads will prevail and we'll move on to what's really important. That's getting kids the best education they can get.
Right. And the reality is in Arizona, I mean, for as long as I can remember, and I've been covering writing about education for 25, 30 years now, kind of just age myself. But
you started in kindergarten?
Exactly. You know, Arizona, you know, with the institution of Ames years ago, we had a standard set of measures that we wanted kids to meet. So if you were a parent of a second grader, a parent of a third grader, you could look and say, in Arizona, this is what my kid's teacher is going to teach them this year. Mm-hmm. And it was a good measure. And I don't think that, I'm not sure I understand the controversy. I'm wanting to make sure that there is sort of a standard understanding of any kid that goes to any school in Arizona will learn a certain thing at a certain age. So I'll be interested to see, you know, how the schools react to that in particular.
Well, briefly, since you're both parents, and Karina, let me start with you. I mean, you guys have to be following this so closely in the sense of what is going on. Do you feel like your individual schools or districts get it as much as they can? When you see your individual districts, are you thinking, wow, I see why we're ranked 48th or 49th, or is there a disconnect?
Well, it's interesting. I think that once you gave parents in Arizona the ability to go to send their kids to school wherever they want in terms of school choice, you know, you had parents who did pay attention, who had the ability to provide transportation or those kinds of things, who are taking their kids to the schools that they know are doing a good job. My kid goes to one of the schools that was just recently listed as one of the top 10 high schools in Arizona. And what I see there is the standards that are being taught with huge amounts of creativity and huge amounts of thoughtfulness. And so that makes me happy. I do worry, you know, when, you know, we push parents, you know, to give tax credit donations and that sort of things, that, you know, it's those schools that are already doing well that will continue to do well because of their either parent support or community support or the district in which, you know, the city in which they're placed, where there are so many other schools that are struggling to do that. Now, there have been some great examples, though, of schools who are following the Common Core, who are raising test scores, who are doing some really good things. So, yeah, it's something that concerns me. I worry where the money goes, you know, and with the order from the judge now to, you know, put Arizona schools to the standards that they were supposed to be held to with an additional, is it $300 million? Mm-hmm. a year, I'm really excited to see what happens, well, with that at all when they get it, but what that will, that kind of money will do for all schools.
Chip, you've really been open about your feelings about the schools.
Yeah, you know, the bottom line is 85% of students in Arizona go to traditional public schools still. So we have these pockets of excellence, usually in affluent areas or with, you know, great charter schools like Arizona School for the Arts, BASIS, the Great Heart System. But those are usually kids who come from middle class, upper middle class, affluent families. And the one common denominator is they all have motivated parents. So unfortunately, you've seen a microcosm of the income equality debate almost in our school system. And I hope the new governor and lawmakers really address that. We can't have a truly great state unless we have a great public school system, not just these pockets of excellence. And I think that's what concerns me the most. People are talking about waiting lists at BASIS and other great charter schools. Hey, that's fine. But they don't have to take everyone like traditional public schools. I mean, you don't see a lot of special needs kids there. You don't see a lot of autistic children. You don't see a lot of English as second language students there. So hopefully this K-12 court case will almost make us, force us to relook, revisit, how do we make the best school system possible?
Well, how much does that affect how you're looking at Doug Ducey as a leader? Because that's one of those things that one would think is going to be a test, whether he decides to continue to pursue the lawsuit, which it looks like he is, or whether, if the lawsuit is finally lost, okay, this is something that's important for our kids.
Yeah, I mean, my prediction would be this year the legislature will try to push off K-12 court ruling for another year so they get through this fiscal year. And then, you know, most legal experts will tell you they're going to lose, the state is going to lose the case eventually. And that's when they're going to have to decide, hey, do we raise taxes? Do we delay corporate income tax cuts? Those are the choices you have to make. And we're going to see, you know, because Doug Ducey has this balancing act, I think. He's very popular with the social conservative crowd, but yet he's also popular with the Phoenix, you know, the Chamber of Commerce, you know, groups. He's going to have to walk that fine line to please both sides. And this education debate is where that will come down. And we may not see it this year, but over the next 2 years, that will play out.
I think it'll be interesting to see. I think that there will be a lot of conversation about it in the state legislature, and I think it will force some sort of action. You know, if you're a governor, you're trying to improve your economy and attract business. I mean, the best way to do that, we know, is with a good education system, not only to attract those businesses here, but to produce the kind of work, the workers that you need in for these industries that are coming here.
That's Karina Bland, Arizona Republic columnist. Also with me is Chip Scutari of the firm Scutari and Sizlak. Still to come on Here and Now, we'll continue our review of 2014 in Arizona with a look at the impact of same-sex marriage. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by the Phoenix Symphony. The 7th Burzendorfer USASU competition finals return. International finalists perform live with the symphony on January 11th. Info at phoenixsymphony.org.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and online at kjzz.org. Taking a look at some temperatures around the state right now, partly sunny skies and 57 degrees in Tucson. It's snowing and 18 up at the Grand Canyon. Snow and 17 degrees in Flagstaff right now. Partly sunny skies and 43 degrees in Casa Grande. Prescott reporting snow and 32. Under fair skies, it's 50 in Yuma.
In 2014, KJZZ brought you the programs you count on every day. And we're committed to doing the same in 2015 with your help. Make your tax-deductible gift at kjzz.org. Thank you.
Valley Freeway is finally clear from the morning's accident on the U.S. 60 eastbound. The earlier crash at the exit ramp at the Loop 101 has been cleared. We should see showers today and cool temperatures in the valley, a high of 51 degrees. We may see up to a half an inch of rain today. Mostly clear overnight with a low near 36 for your New Year's Eve. And then tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny and a high of 51. Light rain and 44 degrees right now at 11:20.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. We're doing kind of a year-in-review 2014. Look ahead to 2015 with Chip Scutari of Scutari and Sizlak and Karina Bland, columnist for the Arizona Republic. Karina, there was a lot of social issue-related stuff in Arizona in 2014. I think SB 1062 probably comes to mind first. What did you think about the reaction to that, sort of the grassroots effort? Did it seem like Arizona to you?
You know, It seemed like Arizona to me that it passed in the first place. The reaction to it was really hopeful for me in the terms that it wasn't, it shows how Arizona's changing. I think you're seeing much more, not only acceptance, I don't even want to say tolerance, but people who aren't going to stand for that kind of sort of open discrimination. You know, anytime that you have a law based on somebody's sincerely held religious belief, anyone can believe anything. So, you know, in terms of being able to couch that in any kinds of, you know, as a freedom for any kind of discrimination, I was heartened to see that kind of response and heartened to see Governor Brewer's response to it.
I think what it shows again is that the legislature, lawmakers are not a true, accurate depiction of the state of Arizona. And I say that because we saw once this bill gained momentum, it had overwhelming votes at the state capitol, but business groups, LGBT groups came out in full force. And it's bad for business, bottom line. It doesn't, you know, the Super Bowl was getting worried. Other big, you know, Fortune 500 companies were mentioning it. And it just shows once again that we have these gerrymandered legislative districts. And people get elected, and they may not truly represent what mainstream Arizona is. You know, a lot of what's projected on Comedy Central and other shows are this whacked out place with 1070 and now this 1062 bill. But if you get away from the state capitol and just talk to people, it's a much different place than what's portrayed in the national media.
Well, especially because it seems like there may be people who are as conservative as what goes on at the legislature, but they have their lives to live. I mean, they have other stuff. Maybe they think 1062 is great, but they also feel like, hey, I've got to get my kids to school. I've got to keep my job. And it's not really a focus on having Arizona be in the headlines. So that's why when we are, it just seems sort of bizarre.
Well, I think at some point, too, as a state lawmaker or a leader in Arizona, you do get tired of those headlines. Like, is this how you want to be portrayed in the national or international media all the time? And that's something that, you know, hopefully people will think about before these kinds of bills are introduced. But I think that with Arizona moving to the approval of same-sex marriage, I think that, you know, it can rule out sort of these kinds of negative things and hopefully show Arizona more in the light of what you actually see here in the community.
Boy, speaking of same-sex marriage, that really came through rapidly because there were, a couple of weeks prior to the judge approving it, plans are already being made for the 2016 ballot measure.
Yeah, I mean, it happened so fast. I mean, now people who have been fighting this battle for 20 years say it's not an overnight success story, but yeah, groups were already gearing up for the 2016 for ballot initiative, and it just happened, bam. So, you know, that's, I think, the biggest story of the year that will last. You know, there's the VA scandal and other things, but when we look back, it was a rapid transformation on what happened just in Arizona. No one thought it would happen in 2014.
When I thought it was, go ahead.
Yeah, as I say, I just thought it was inevitable too. And for me, a real gauge of that was when Tom Horn said he wouldn't fight it. And I was like, okay, then we're done here in Arizona. And in becoming, I think, the 31st state to pass that, you know, it becomes an issue of, much like 1062, is a issue of not gay rights, but of human rights. And I think that people are beginning to understand that more, too.
And when you talk to the younger generation, I don't know, Karina's son's 15, mm-hmm. you know, our older kids are 13, 14. When you mention this issue to them, they just say, why wouldn't they let, you know, gay or lesbian people get married? It just doesn't make any sense. So the next generation, it's just a total no-brainer. So it'll be interesting 4 years from now when the next statewide election happens. Will there still be Republicans who are, you know, pro-traditional marriage? And will that hurt them, you know, in a general election where independents and Democrats are voting?
Well, and I think the Republicans, you know, if they do want to expand their base, they have to stop alienating people who have, you know, who think differently than they do, who have family members who are gay or who are in relationships themselves. And I think that moving away from the idea that this is unusual, you know, that it just has to be acceptable.
Finally on this, though, when we think about folks who do have, whether it's a phrase in legislation or not, who do have sincerely held beliefs, is there a feeling that folks like that who may be offended by this, are we going to see sort of the back against the wall, and so fights like this in some ways continue, even if they're not legal fights, because people feel like, well, wait a second, that's not the Arizona I want to live in? Does that create issues or no?
I mean, I think the side that's pro same-sex marriage has to be careful not to pigeonhole or stereotype every person, politician, who is for traditional marriage. That's their right, and that's what they believe. So hopefully there won't be too much of a harsh push on that side and show, you know, objectivity, show fairness to all sides of the issue.
Yeah, because, Karina, when we get into this idea of tolerance, I mean, we always think about open-mindedness, and there is that feeling of, yeah, there are people who raise a certain way, think a certain way, and may not be doing it in particular specifically because they want to hurt someone else's feelings.
Right. Well, I do think, you know, it comes to a point with a lot of issues that the government has had to install laws before people actually felt that way, whether it's, you know, segregation or, I mean, we often, there are laws that go against what people believe, and I think that it can continue to hold those beliefs, and I think it will become a scenario where they begin to just not talk about it so publicly as, you know, as they have with other issues. So
I think the next battlefront in this issue will be, there could possibly be a 2016 ballot initiative called ENDA, which is Ending Discrimination in the Workplace. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if that's on the ballot, or if that comes to certain city councils where they have to either sign a pledge or pass an ordinance about not discriminating against, you know, same-sex couples in the workplace or, you know, their health benefits. So that's probably the next battle lines on this issue.
And it may not be as huge as you think when you look at the number of cities that have, you know, within the state who have already passed those sort of ordinances or have signed those pledges. I think another area that will come up with this is also is in the area, there's still some adoption inequities when it comes to gay parents. And I think that that will have to come through the legislature too, because that law is still on the book regardless of the fact that we have same-sex marriage now. So,
good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein with Karina Bland of the Arizona Republic and Chip Scutari of Scutari and Sizlak. We're looking back to 2014 and looking ahead to 2015 in Arizona. Chip, just because it got so many headlines and it affected so many people, especially we've got more people coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, the VA scandal, the fact that it affected so many lives and it got started here in Phoenix. What are some of the things that stand out to you about that?
Just for me personally, you know, my father's a veteran, and for these men and women who defend our freedom all over the world or, you know, throughout the United States, for their waiting time to be that long, that they could suffer this much, it was just absolutely appalling to me. Just not getting into the actual nuances of what happened or didn't happen, but just hearing that, hopefully our federal lawmakers will make this a top priority. We take such great pride in our military. Let's make sure when they come back from the battlefields that they're taken care of. Just hearing that really, I mean, just disgusted me. And hopefully changes will come a little more rapidly than they have been so far.
And I think, you know, I was super proud of the work that the Republic's Dennis Wagner did on that story, and I really quite marveled at the changes that took place just in the course of this year. Like, obviously, there's still a lot of things that need to be done. I'm the daughter of a Marine. My cousin just got out of the Marine Corps and has had trouble getting some services at the VA. I have a Marine Corps friend, an old man who's still waiting, you know, 6 weeks, eight weeks for an appointment. But I think things are getting better, and for the people who need the help the most, I think there's a better triage system that's happening. But exactly, I think that can only get better, obviously, and I do think that with so many people looking at it, that it has to. And then the question is once sort of the media attention goes away and the official accountability goes away, how do you then continue that?
I think that's part of the frustration I've heard from so many people, is this idea that words have meaning. We always hear this. And not to pick on our senior senator, but someone who one would think would know the military better than anyone else, went through this horrible experience as a POW. And it seems like after things came out, then he was out front, he's going to do this. Why does it take, in so many aspects of human life, why does it take tragedies for us to actually act on things? Big philosophical question, Jeff.
Yeah, that's a tough answer. I think, not to make an excuse for any politician, but a lot of times throughout the day, there are a million issues going on. You get wrapped up in, you know, whatever course of the day is going. But hopefully on this issue with the VA scandal, Senator McCain, our other members of Congress, will put aside partisan differences. It's probably going to take more money, more funds. And they're going to have to deal with that. Because it's easy to talk tough. It's harder to vote that way and spend more money when you may be criticized from the Tea Party wing of your base. Mm-hmm. So hopefully those guys will all step up, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, and make this right.
Well, and you also have to remember that there was like, this was sort of a hidden problem. Like there were concerted efforts to keep it secret. And so, you know, with it, without really the whistleblowers who stepped forward and said this is wrong, you know, I'm not sure how much longer, then this would have gone on for much longer. And so, you know, I think that it does sometimes take a tragedy. It takes brave people to stand up and say, you know, this is happening. The goal now would be to make sure that once there are some changes, that it doesn't lag again, you know, mm-hmm. because you often see that, especially in any kind of scenario like medical care or, you know, child protective services, which I hope we're going to talk about too, is anytime you have crushing caseloads, somebody needs to do something to make it look like it's all going well. So if we really focus on the caseloads, I think that, and those numbers are easy, and that's something that somebody should be monitoring every month to make sure that we don't find out 5 years later that things have gotten out of hand again.
Now, one final thought on the VA. Mm-hmm. When you think about it, the American military is one of our last institutions that's held in such high regard. We've seen Congress been pilloried, you know, the White House, the presidency, but the American military is one of our last standing principles of honor, and that's really held in high esteem all across the political spectrum. So hopefully in 2015, they could find the funding, find the reforms that will take care of our soldiers returning from battle.
Man, Karina, you mentioned CPS. Let's go on to that. Based on the changes you saw, what are you optimistic about, and how closely do we still need to keep an eye on that? As, again, we talked about with VA, when it gets out of the headlines.
Well, and that, you know, for me, I would love to be optimistic, but I'm really not, because, you know, I covered CPS for a decade, and, you know, in the mid-90s, we were writing these same stories that routinely, you know, 2,500 cases or referrals were being overlooked every month. There, you know, I remember at one point in 1997, it was like more than almost 3,500, and you had kind of the same kind of outrage, and there were some shuffling of the deck chairs, and there was a hotline, and there were all these different kinds of things that then things get better for a while, and then they tank again every time, and every time it does come down to caseloads. There are some agencies in the United States that do this well, and I think that what we're doing now is a different kind of model, and so maybe this one will be the one that works. But I do think that we need to kind of focus on who does what well and then try to grab some of those programs. But, you know, right now it's really sort of, they're operating in a crisis mode. We've got too many kids in foster care. But, you know, this is a problem that I remember in 2005, we had so many kids under the age of 6 in shelters that, you know, there were threats of a federal lawsuit. You know, this problem never goes away. And I like seeing that the governor has dedicated someone who solely will keep an eye on this. Again, the data's all there if you want to watch it, and nobody, and what, when things go wrong is when nobody is watching the data to see what's happening. You can't stop parents from mistreating or predict who's going to mistreat their kids. So when something goes wrong, and the caseworkers are always the ones that are held responsible, but I think as a society, we have to start looking at the system as a whole. You know, there are police agencies involved, there are judges involved, there are advocates involved. Like, I think we have to start looking at it from a level that it's not just CPS's fault when something goes wrong, and that how do you provide those sources of support for them. But again, the caseloads, I spent a year following a new caseworker one time, and I would leave those days that I spent with her just defeated. Like, I don't know how, like I said, I could be a caseworker if I had a caseload of one. But, you know, their caseloads, there's no way to juggle all of that. Like, there just isn't. And so we know what the national standards are, and I think if we can come close to them, that we'll have a much better success rate at dealing with these cases.
I think much like the VA situation with CPS reform, it comes down to money. And not that money's the answer for everything. It has to be accountability measures tied to those. But Governor Brewer, you know, took a bold step by making CPS its own agency. And now it's really going to be up to the Ducey administration, the state legislature, to see how they continue that, which is going to be incredibly difficult given a $1 billion deficit. So there's going to be a lot of people, you know, eyeing that limited pot of funds. So I think it's still to be determined, but Governor Brewer should get kudos for separating out CPS as its own agency. I think that will help in the long run.
We've talked about a lot of heavy stuff, guys. Okay, so I want to see if there's something. It can be anything. It can be sports, culture, whatever. Something in Arizona stood out to you, Chip, in 2014 where you said eureka, or just made you laugh, made you smile, something made you excited?
You know, as everyone can tell when they look at my pear-shaped body, I'm a big fan of food. So what I think is great, and this pertains to business and to the economy, but our foodie culture in the last 5 to 8 years has just blossomed. And maybe people may say, oh, who cares about foodie? But we have these great chefs, these entrepreneurs, these innovators. I think this year we had 6 chefs that were finalists for the James Beard Award. Now, to put that into context, that's like being a finalist for an Academy Award. So we have these very talented chefs, restaurateurs, who are doing great things. It helps our Valley of the Sun feel more cosmopolitan. You know, same goes with our wine industry. Down in Sonoyta, Patagonia, up in Cottonwood and Wilcox, it takes a lot to run a winery, to plant the grapes, to do all that. 2 or 3 years of hardship, you don't know how it's going to turn out. And I think the combination of our food culture and our burgeoning wine, blossoming wine industry bodes well for the future, because that's going to attract people here.
Karina, after having some food and wine, what are your thoughts?
Well, I was going to say, yeah, I mean, that's what, I look really good on radio because I look really slender. But, you know, that is one of the things that you do see people talking about now is like, where are you going? You know, where are you out to this weekend? And I think it does bring sort of a flair and a culture to Arizona. You see more people going to the theater. You see more people going to concerts. I mean, it's just is, it seems like there's a sort of a burgeoning, it's a burgeoning place to be in terms of entertainment. We moved here when I started high school 30-something years ago. And, you know, my brother left for Seattle and used to wear a T-shirt that said Phoenix is boring. And he still claims that's true when he comes back at Christmas. But I do think it's a much different, much more vibrant community. And you see it, especially in the areas where people are walking and they're taking light rail and they, you know, they're going from one place to the next in sort of more of this cosmopolitan way.
Yeah. Speaking of that, I would have to say this in my wife's honor. But you see, speaking of entrepreneurs and risk takers, you see these redevelopers who are building along light rail line, which is called transit-oriented development. Mm-hmm. You know, like perfect examples at 3rd Avenue and Camelback, the Newton, where they've redone, transformed the old Beefeater site, and there's a Changing Hands bookstore, there's energy down there. All these things happening all along light rail, and they're not getting help from the state capital. They're doing it on their own, and that gives me optimism, and that's the true can-do spirit of Arizona I love since I've moved out from the East Coast. Mm-hmm. People will say if they're going to do something like these chefs, or whether you're redeveloping along light rail line, it's happening, and no one's going to stop them.
Well, and I think people did wonder, like, who's going to ride the light rail? You know, sure. It's like riding the bus. But when you get on the light rail, it's packed, and, you know, and that's one of the things that I think that Arizona said they wanted that. Mm-hmm. And given it, they're using it. So,
and speaking of that, in 2015, I think there'll be a ballot initiative in the city of Phoenix to expedite more miles of light rail line. I don't remember how many miles exactly, but I believe it'll pass and there'll be more and more miles of light rail for people to ride.
Chip Scutari of Scutari and Sizlak, Karina Bland of the Arizona Republic. You can read her on Sundays. Guys, thanks.
Thank you.
And
thank
happy
you.
2015.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Still to come on this special edition of KJZZ's Here and Now, we'll look back at one of the most famous artists in Arizona history, Ted DeGrazia, and listen to a couple of very funny people, Jenny Molin and Chelsea Peretti. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by the Children's Museum of Phoenix, featuring 300-plus hands-on activities for children and adults to enjoy together. Children'sMuseumOfPhoenix.org.
Good morning. This is Here and Now on 91.5 KJZZ. We should see showers around the valley today, a high of 51 degrees, mostly clear skies overnight for your New Year's Eve with a low in the mid-30s, and then partly to mostly sunny skies for tomorrow with a high of 51 degrees. Join us at noon for Here and Now from Boston. Today, California's ban on single-use plastic bags is on hold, as opponents gathered over 800,000 signatures to put the measure on the 2016 ballot. And we'll hear about some looming security issues around the world as 2015 approaches. NPR's Here and Now starts at noon. Snowing and 17 degrees right now in Flagstaff. It's mostly sunny and 56 in Tucson. Mostly cloudy and 48 degrees in Yuma. Mostly cloudy, light rain reported in some parts of the valley, and it's 44 degrees at 1140.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. I grew up in Phoenix and have lived here for nearly 40 years, so sometimes on the program we'll talk about Phoenix and Arizona history. Back in March of this year, I talked with a couple of journalists about one of the most famous artists in the state's history. Ted DeGrazia is highly regarded naturally for his art, but he's widely known more because of his talent for and commitment to marketing his work. DeGrazia was born in 1909 in the Arizona mining town of Morenci. Journalists Jim and Marilyn Johnson chronicled DeGrazia's life in their book, DeGrazia, The Man and the Myths. We started our conversation by talking about some of the things that stood out about DeGrazia as a person and an artist.
He is noted as the world's most reproduced artist. He produced art on everything from canvas to tortillas and trinkets and all kinds of stuff. And he was a very charismatic character, if you want to put it that way, who carried on this persona that was attractive to people. He said one time that people expect artists to be eccentric, so I'm eccentric.
He may have pioneered the whole idea of putting your art on trinkets. Nowadays, an artist who can get away with that, it's called licensing. And, you know, they'd go crazy if they're well known enough to do that. DeGrazia seems to have started that whole thing, and it made him rather wealthy. He became internationally known for a painting called Los Niños that UNICEF put on its Christmas card in 1950. And if you're at all familiar with those cards, there are still some around. His style is not traditional art style. He had a very difficult time at the U of A with the art department because they wanted him to paint in the more classical, well-known style, and he came to the university with his own technique already honed. And so he painted in most of his life, I think, with a palette knife. And so his paintings are strong strokes, pretty simple. And yet there's a story to all of his paintings behind all of them.
One of the good stories they tell is, you know, he painted the little girls with the dots for eyes and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And one time a visitor at the studio asked him, why don't you have eyes? And he said, well, I missed a class that day when they taught eyes. And she says, oh, only one more class, she said.
What was DeGrazia's appearance like? How did he dress?
What you saw was what you got with DeGrazia. He dressed like an old prospector. You know, he'd wear old jeans and a flannel shirt with a red handkerchief in his back pocket and an old beat-up hat. That became a persona that he discovered helped him to sell his artwork. But also he was a prospector. He loved the reservations and the open space of the Southwest. And often when the city closed in on him, now mind you, he was always on the edge of the city, but when the city closed in on him, he would take off and go to one of the reservations looking for a festival or just to be around Native Americans. He often said he wished he could be one.
His clothes that he wore also was work clothes when he was building the mission and building the gallery and building his house up there. I mean, that was the way he dressed to work and to paint. I mean, and then he became so recognizable that way. He even when he went to funerals and weddings, he would dress the same way. He was given a Distinguished Alumni Award by the University of Arizona, and he wore that outfit underneath his cap and gown. He was a very recognizable person. If he had worn a suit somewhere, nobody would have known who he was.
What would he say to the more traditional artists who might have looked down, frankly, if we think about the stereotype, would look down on someone who marketed himself so well? Did he have a retort that he would throw back at people?
I don't know that he had a standard retort, but he certainly he did not tolerate pretension in any form, and he considered artists who looked down on him to be pretty pretentious, I think.
He didn't have any use at all for critics. He paid no attention to them. And he was noted as the artist of the people, and they called it kitsch, what he put out, which means it catered to the lowbrow. But he tried to paint for the people, and people could afford to buy his artwork. That was his secret. And they loved it. I mean, the middle-class guy, the guy that came driving across from Ohio or something, he came to Tucson because they saw pictures of him and his artwork in Arizona highways. They would come out here just to see his stuff as part of their Southwest tour. And he wanted to have priced paintings that they could afford to take home.
There's a story in the book about this began when he was in Rosita's restaurant, which is part of his Campbell and Prince studio, which is no longer there. The family sold the property, and it's a Chevron gas station now. He was in Rosita's, and there was a little girl with her mother, and the little girl was staring at the paintings on the wall with longing, and he overheard the mother telling her daughter, you can have a painting or you can have lunch, but you can't have both. And de Grazia didn't want her to miss lunch, so he gave her a painting. And that got him to thinking about creating an art and making art that could be affordable to anyone. So he found a way to make have prints made of his art. He, after a certain point, he never sold his original art. It was all prints. And then he put it on everything. We've met people with de Grazia necklaces.
He sold, in 1 year, he sold 50,000 magnets with little pictures on them.
My wife brought out her set of magnets earlier this week to show me. She just put them on our fridge this week, yeah. Tell the story of the dramatic action de Grazia took because he was not real happy with the IRS at one point.
He knew he was getting towards the end of his life, and he didn't know what he was going to do with his paintings. So he found out the IRS said that if he wanted to donate them, say, to a museum somewhere, he could get right off the value of the materials. That's it. But if he left it to his children, they had to pay inheritance tax based on the value of the paintings if they were sold. And he thought that was grossly unfair. So he went up into the Superstition Mountains with about 20 other people, built this pyre that was, probably 7 feet high, put some paintings on it, threw some of his favorite Chivas Regal scotch on it, threw a match to it, and burned it up. He said he was crying as he was watching this burn up. Well, as it turns out, and the paper said there was about $1.5 million worth of artwork that went up in flames. And when he got back, his friend of his, a guy named Abe Channon, asked him about that. And he says, well, you know, he says, Abe, those aren't some of my best paintings. And since I burned all of those paintings, I'm selling more than I ever did. It was the best scheme I ever came up with.
Jim and Marilyn Johnson are the authors of the book de Grazia, The Man and the Myths. That conversation first aired in March of this year. This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. If you've watched the award-winning Fox sitcom Brooklyn Nine-Nine, then you know comedian and actress Chelsea Peretti. Here she is in a scene with Andre Brower.
Gina.
Sorry, I was playing Crazy Cupcakes.
Crazy Cupcakes?
Crazy with a W, a backwards W. There's
no such thing as a backwards W.
Yeah, there is. See? Okay, how you play, you just line up three cupcakes with the same color frosting. Kaboom.
And this little game of yours, it's more interesting to you than your work?
Yeah. Crazy Cupcakes is a lot more interesting than this.
Stop playing crazy. And stop playing this inane garbage. It's embarrassing.
Say it to my face.
I did. You were looking at your phone.
Oh, cool. My bae.
Along with her acting, Peretti has been a writer for Parks and Recreation. She's also a longtime stand-up comic. I asked Peretti how picky she is about the roles that she takes.
You know, it's a weird thing because when you're first starting out in any kind of entertainment, you're basically saying yes to everything that, you know, comes your way. And then it gets harder as you go along to say yes to everything just because of time constraints. But, you know, I usually go with things that I like the talent involved or the creators. I mean, obviously, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, it's Dan Gore and Mike Schur, and I worked with them on Parks and Recreation.
You're known for also, as you mentioned, Parks and Recreation, being a comedy writer, too. So talk about the obvious challenges of that when you're writing for yourself as a stand-up versus writing for other people.
I know some comedians feel differently, but I actually found it a nice respite to write for other people because, you know, for years and years of stand-up, you're writing to your own voice. So I sort of enjoyed the fantasy of getting into a different person's way of thinking or talking, and getting to write for someone else is a nice break as a stand-up. So at Parks and Rec, you know, there's such a big ensemble that you really could float around into a lot of different personalities, and I kind of enjoyed it, the escape from myself.
So what about the difference between being a successful stand-up and then you're part of an ensemble cast and vice versa? What do you like about one over the other?
You know, I've always been someone who really enjoys collaborating. I know there's some stand-ups that are very much lone soldiers. They like to do everything kind of on their own. But I really enjoy writing in a team, and likewise, I enjoy acting with a bunch of other people. You kind of get to have your take on the script, and then we come together to shoot it, and you see the other actor's takes, and then you adjust and find this kind of synergy between your two individual or multiple people's kind of visions for the scene. So it's exciting to kind of see it come alive as each character enters.
You have a persona on stage, or are we seeing you? And I don't want to make this comparison that you've worked with her, but I was watching Sarah Silverman on HBO last week, and she has that thing where pretty much everything she says is hilarious, but she says it in this sort of innocent girl way. And I'm wondering, so she definitely has a persona on stage. Do you have something like that?
I think I tend to actually be closer to myself in the sense of, you know, if I'm saying an opinion, it's generally going to be pretty close to my actual personal opinions. I think that most stand-up, you know, if you're trying to get people to laugh, you're going to go for the strongest way to say something. So there's definitely, like, a side of myself that doesn't always come out in stand-up, which is the side that I probably explore in therapy or in my personal relationships with people, but it might not be the funniest side of myself. I've interacted with people who are, like, surprised that I'm sensitive or thoughtful, and I'm like, no, I mean... stand-up, I'm not trying to share that side of myself 100% of the time because it wouldn't be quite as funny, I think.
Well, and how is the comedy business right now for a female stand-up? And is there more pressure on a female to crack a lot of jokes and not be as sensitive because people might have the stereotype, well, a woman's going to be, she is going to share those things more likely or right. more often than a man will?
I think a lot of stand-ups, men and women, have a pressure to and feel that they have to put on a tough exterior for audiences to respect them. I definitely think coming up for me, I've felt a real sense of low expectations for a female comedian, and so I've felt like I had to prove myself. But I also think that things are really changing, and I think that it's a really rich scene right now. You know, Sarah Silverman and Joan Rivers, those were people I looked up to, and now there's so many female comedians that are really strong and I think changing the way that people see stand-up comedy, which I think mostly, historically, people just think of it as a male medium with male legends, and I think that's shifting.
Well, and as part of that shift, do you think women will be able to be, I mean, you can have the women who tell the personal stories, you can have the women who just do one-liners too, because it does seem like the normal sort of average white guy comedian can encompass everything, but when it comes down, we break it down to African-American or female, we have certain expectations going in, and until we get to the point where everyone can sort of be funny about everything, we're not quite there yet.
Yeah, well, that's why, like, sometimes people will say a divisive thing to me about another female in entertainment and comedy or stand-up, where they're like, she sucks, you're great. And I'm like, you know, I just try not to bite at that stuff because for me, anytime any woman is successful, even if her stand-up isn't my cup of tea, that's a good thing, you know, because there's all kinds of different voices for male comedians and there should be all kinds of different voices for women.
What makes you laugh, and are you comfortable kind of laughing at anything?
I will always laugh if I'm in a situation where I'm not supposed to laugh.
Okay.
You know, like if I'm in a serious environment, which recently happened to me where I was like in this massage, I got a massage and there was this little room afterwards where like you sit afterwards and they give you some water and stuff. And I just started laughing hysterically in there because we were supposed to be quiet for the other people. Anyway, whatever, this is probably not relatable in any way, but yeah, like, you know, I remember like formal dinners as a kid, I would always get the giggles. There's just, you know, there's an array.
Comedian and actress Chelsea Peretti, she's one of the stars of the Fox comedy Brooklyn Nine-Nine. We talked to her back in May. What if you were an actress who kept narrowly missing out on the jobs you really wanted? And what if you were married to a pretty famous actor who has more Twitter followers than you do? If you're Jenny Molin, you write a book and try to get people to laugh with you and at your pain. Molin is the author of I Like You Just the Way I Am. It's a very open, some might say graphic, account of her life. her marriage to actor Jason Biggs, and growing up in Phoenix as the daughter of Dr. Art Mullen, who for decades has been the go-to expert for a number of local TV stations. I caught up with her as she was driving around Los Angeles and asked her whether she's being completely open in her book or holding something back.
I don't really hold back a lot, I have to say. I don't really know how to hold back. That's sort of my problem. I'm working on it.
People are so used to someone saying stuff, they feel like, wow, no one says these, and then they just presume you're not saying everything. But, well, how did you feel about opening up this much? How did you get to the point where you wanted to open up?
Well, I would say that, you know, it's not that I'm not just as embarrassed as the next person about all of these crazy misadventures I find myself getting into, but I'm not ashamed of them, and it makes me feel, I think, more sane to be able to talk about them than holding them inside.
People probably, even now, still kind of stereotype a funny woman, how a funny woman should be. How do you feel about that? How do you feel about what maybe the perception of what they expect a funny female to be as opposed to a funny man?
Well, I think that people expect a funny female to be sort of like slutty and body and just kind of out there in a different way. I think that men can get away with things that women can't. People meet me in person and I'm oftentimes shocked by how normal I come across. I think they expect me to be this like outlandish, crazy sexual predator, and I'm not. I'm just like an honest person talking about, you know, my inner world.
You wanted to be an actress, but did you think of yourself as a funny person too, or did that develop as you became more mature?
No, I think I just like eventually started laughing at all of my pain. And then I was okay. Like, oh, maybe I am funny. I don't know. I think meeting Jason is really when I found my voice.
Well, did he think you were funny, or was he just, because he loved you, he wanted to encourage you more, and then you found out that you were funny?
No, I think he thinks I'm, like, the most hilarious person he's ever met.
Oh, that's cool. Okay.
He's not here right now. He's not here right now, so I can say that. But I think when he started saying, you're so funny, I had to look at myself and say, am I funny? Maybe I am.
I grew up in Phoenix myself. So your dad has been like the sort of go-to TV doctor in Phoenix for decades. So how has your dad reacted to how you characterize him in the book, which is funny, but also like even the fact that is there really a photo of your dad holding a photo of himself? Because if that's true, that's hilarious.
But there are enough photos of my dad in his house alone that I felt justified in writing that.
Okay.
My dad likes to think that I just like exaggerate everything and that it's all a work of fiction. And I think he's probably himself going to be shocked when he goes to the bookstore and it's not in the fiction aisle. But I think he's proud. I think he's a little upset that I included certain things about him. But I couldn't help it. And I honestly, most women in Arizona who, you know, haven't been married for years have probably dated my dad. So they probably agree with my description of him.
All right. Who's more famous now, you or your dad?
Oh, my gosh. I hope that I am. I don't know. In his mind, I think he always will be, though.
Okay. You write a lot about your mom in the book, too. Now, how has being a mom changed how you view life? Are there things that you learned from her that are good things and bad things and that are going to make you a better mom or no?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think my mom, the thing about my mom that I love and I will always be so grateful for is that she was so open and just honest about who she was. She was wild and crazy, but she didn't shelter us and she didn't really try to like pretend that she wasn't who she was. And I think I have that sort of internal need to rebel because I saw my mom doing it all the time.
Yeah.
And she embraced that part of herself. And I feel like that's why I can be so kind of like out there with the things that I put out. I don't feel any shame around it because, you know, my mom did up a lot of crazy things and didn't have remorse about it.
That's actress and author Jenny Mollen. Her book is called I Like You Just the Way I Am. We talked with Mollen when the book was published in June of this year. That's all for today's special edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. If you want to catch up with this program again or relive 2014 with some of our past programs, please go online later today to kjzz.org. If you have a smartphone, you can also download the KJZZ app. You can follow the program on Twitter at KJZZ Here and Now, and you can follow me at Off Center Voice.